All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio. This is Veterans Radio. And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, United States Army helicopter pilot in Vietnam 1969, Chief Warrant Officer number 2. Welcome to Veterans Radio today. We've got I think we have a great program for you, very interesting. We are going to be talking with a group called the Brave Hearts. And the Brave Hearts is a riding organization that helps veterans by introducing them to horses and to riding. And they've got a couple of really big events that are coming up in the next couple of weeks. So I want you to stick around for that. And then in the second half of the program, we're going to be talking about one of my favorite actors is Jimmy Stewart. And we have the author Robert Mattson on the program, and his book is entitled Mission, Jimmy Stewart and the Fight for Europe. I bet many of you out there knew that Jimmy Stewart was a pilot during World War II. We kind of took a big break in his acting career. And we're going to be talking with Robert about his career before World War II, what he did during World War II, and how it affected his life afterwards. So you got to stick around to make sure that you hear all of these, I think, really important issues that are going to be going on. Today's program is brought to you by Legal Help for Veterans. This is a Veterans Disability Claim Office here and locally, and that's all they do. So give Legal Help for Veterans a call today. That number is 800-693-4800, and that's 800-693-4800. They will do everything they can to make sure that you get whatever benefits you are entitled to. And we're also brought to you by American House. American House, Westland, Vinoy, is a senior living community. It's on Vinoy Road in Westland, Michigan. It's called the Bed and Breakfast at Senior Living. It's really a great place for you, and they've got active participation with Medicaid waivers, Section 8, housing vouchers, VA aid, and attendance programs. So contact the American House in Westland, Michigan. That number is 734-326-7777. 734-326-7777. So please, contact our sponsors. Let them know that you heard about them on Veterans Radio. It's really important to us and to you. I think you'll find out that they can help you out. All right, as we always do, we go through a number of events, and there are quite a few coming up here, but the big three, I guess you could say. Number one is the Vietnam Veterans of America Charlie Kettles Chapter 310 here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, is having their annual pig roast, and that is coming up next Sunday, September 9th, from noon to 4 p.m. Where is it going to be? It's going to be at the VFW Post 423. The address is 3230 South Wagner Road in Ann Arbor. This is a great event. It's something I think that you would enjoy. The tickets are $10 to get in. Kids 6 to 12 is $5. If you're under 6, it's free at the gate. There are going to be all kinds of things there for you. We've got a helicopter, a Huey helicopter out there. I get to be the expert in charge of talking all about the Huey that day. We've got a tank. We've got artillery. We've got great food. We've got entertainment. There's a raffle going on. In fact, one of the raffle prizes that some of you may be interested in this, I hope, you get to co-host a program with me here on Veterans Radio. But you got to go down there, and hopefully you'll buy the raffle tickets. And I think there's going to be a little silent auction. Maybe that's a silent auction prize. I'll have to put in some money to make sure that somebody comes along with me. So that's the annual pig roast there, is Vietnam Veterans of America, Charlie Kettles, Chapter 310. That's next Sunday, September 9th, noon to 4, on South Wagner Road in Ann Arbor. For more information, you can contact Don Miller. His number is 734-864-2819. Don's put a lot of effort into this, and the men and women of the VVA 310 are going to be out there roasting up the pigs all night before the 9th, so go out and check them out, would you please? The other thing that's coming up, one of the other things that's coming up, is Patriots Day. And Patriots Day is coming up on Saturday, September 15th. And this is going to be at the American House Senior Living Community in Sterling Heights, Michigan. And Patriots Day this year is going to be, as I mentioned, on September 15th. It runs from 1 to 4 p.m. Let's see, we've got Circuit Court Judge Michael Warren. Founded Patriot Week in a time to reflect on the values and history of our great country. So starting on September 11th, the day to honor 3,000 Americans who lost their lives in 2001, and ending with a September 17th Constitution Day. The week will include a variety of ceremonies and celebrations, but the big day is going to be Saturday, September 15th from 1 to 4 at the American House on 15 Mile Road in Sterling Heights, Michigan, again from 1 to 4. Please call this number. And they didn't give me the number. I'll make sure I get it up. We'll put it up on our website to make sure that you have it, and you can make reservations if necessary. But, yeah, that's September 15th. And the last one is on September 16th. We've got another fundraiser, and this is the Firing Line Gun Range. It's having their fifth annual Firing Line Barbecue to raise money for veterans. This is on September 16th. And this is also runs, I believe this is from 1 to 4 p.m. as well. And they've got, this is located at 33,000 Ford Road in Westland, Michigan. This is the Firing Line. They're going to be raising funds for the Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund here in Michigan, and also for the Veterans Memorial Garden of Westland. And they are looking for gifts or donations. Their goal is to try and raise $40,000 this year. Good for them, good for them. So they're looking for different tactical t-shirts, all kinds of things, gun cases, hats, mugs, backpacks, so forth. They're going to also have a number of gun raffles and so forth, where they are raffling off all kinds of different pistols and rifles, and all proceeds benefit veterans. You need not be present to win. Only one gun per ticket, it says. So we want you to get a hold of Don High. His number is 734-326-7320. That is 734-326-7320. Or you can go to their website. That's the firinglineguns.com and find out more information about that. Ooh, a lot of things are going on. A lot of things are going on in the area, and I'm sure that a lot of things are going also all around the country with 9/11 coming up again. So check your local papers or check your local veterans organization. I'm sure that you've got something that will help you out with that. All right, we're going to take a real quick break, and we will be back with our guest from the Bravehearts Riding. And, yeah, I think it's going to be kind of a cool interview. So stick around. We'll be right back after this quick message. And we're back on Veterans Radio. In our first segment of the program today, we're going to be talking with an organization called Bravehearts Riding. And joining me on the line, first of all, is Megan Hill McQueenie. And she is the president and CEO. Megan, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi. Thank you so much for having us. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having this whole program that you've got going there. I wanted to ask you, Megan, especially, what is Bravehearts and what is it that you're attempting to do?
Bravehearts is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We're based out of Illinois, and we are the largest program in the country that services veterans with horses. We have a whole plethora of innovative programs that are all set up at no cost for our veterans. And we are repeating what we did last year, which is called the Trail to Zero. We will be riding 20 miles September 8th through Washington, D.C., and then we'll be riding another 20 miles September 15th through downtown New York City. We ride 20 miles for awareness of the 20 veterans that we lose every day in the United States, and also for an answer for veterans to know that programs with horses, like what we do at Bravehearts, do exist and do provide answers for assisting vets in their darkest times.
Well, I just think it's a great program, and it sounds really interesting to me. I was talking with my wife earlier. I was going, I wonder how I get to ride a horse in that thing. You're going to have one in Chicago or Detroit. Probably you could have them all over the country. I'll bet you could have a lot of people that would show up for that.
There are a lot of programs across the country that do exist, like Bravehearts, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. How did you get involved with this?
I've been in the field of therapeutic riding for about 25 years. And I got invited to come out and judge one of Bravehearts' horse shows about 11 years ago, and just fell in love with the program and the people and the horses and what their mission really was, and started to work with their founders as far as really trying to design some innovative programs based on what the veterans' needs and wants were.
Mm-hmm. How and where are you located in Illinois?
We have two farms. We're located in both Harvard and in Poplar Grove.
Now, are these anywhere near Chicago? I'm not that familiar with Illinois.
Yeah, we're sort of in between Chicago and Rockford. We service a lot of VA hospitals throughout Chicago, downtown Chicago, Jesse Brown, North Chicago, Hines VA hospitals, and then also Milwaukee VA.
Okay.
So we're northwest of Chicago. Mm-hmm.
I had a friend who was telling me about a program. He went to the VA in North Chicago. I can't remember the name of it, but he said that one of the days they went out to a horse farm and veterans were, you know, introduced to the horses, and some of them actually got to ride, but most of them were just having the horses come up to them. And I don't know how I just think it's a great idea, because I know horses are seem to have a way of connecting with people, especially when people have emotional issues that are going on in their lives.
Yes, they do. Horses are really special. They connect with people on a wide variety of people that are not just emotional, physical, cognitive. You know, horses really tend to fill in the gaps of where our shortcomings are. They definitely give us a good mirror as far as areas that we can get better on. And they just provide a really special way that, you know, people, what I hear so often is so many veterans talk about how really nothing else works, mm-hmm. like what a horse really began to do for helping get their lives pointed in the right direction.
Well, we've got a couple of people on the line right now, Megan, that we're going to talk to find out how this program really helped them. I really appreciate what you are doing with Brave Hearts, and I encourage people to go to your website, which is braveheartsriding.org, and there's a lot of information on there about how you can get involved as a volunteer and also how you can participate in the programs that you have available.
That'd be great. And we also have another website, trailtozero.org, that specifically talks about our two big upcoming rides next Saturday and then the following Saturday, September 8th and September 15th.
Okay. What time are those rides, by the way?
Well, we leave at 8 a.m. Both mornings, and our rides will take us probably between 6 to 7.5 hours before we're completed. We're doing it with 11 veterans. And a Gold Star father, and we will have 13 of our horses on hand.
Wow! And could anybody ride with you if they wanted to, or do they need to get in touch with you? Probably a liability issue, I'm guessing.
what we actually do is this is just our second year, so we're just getting started. We actually chose veterans who ride with us at Braveheart, mm-hmm. and also our certified instructors. So these are veterans who actually started with us in the program and really worked their way up, and now are also teaching other veterans about horses. So we feel like they're the best spokespeople. Plus, a lot of these vets who are going to be on the ride can also speak to, you know, how important the horses have really helped shape and change their lives.
Okay. All right. Well, I think it's a really great idea, and I encourage people to go to your website. You mentioned the other website to find out more about the ride was Trail to Zero. Is that trailtozero.com or?
It's trailtozero.org. Yes, sir.
.org. Okie doke. All right, Megan. Well, thank you very much. Let's go over, and I want to talk to Ken Boyd. Ken, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much, Ken, for agreeing to be on the program. Yours is kind of it's a very sad but very unusual story of how did you get involved with the this organization?
Yeah, it is a sad story. My wife and I are Gold Star parents. We mm-hmm. had lost our son, who was a corporal in the Marine Corps, CJ, August 19th of 2010. He was doing what he loved, doing what he wanted to do, being a Marine, but... Then, you know, as we struggle, you know, to find a way forward and everything, Bravehearts actually found my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we started to become involved. You know, as we talk about it, you know, every night you kind of seem to go to the edge of that cliff all the time. And, they did a Gold Star Mothers retreat, and my wife went there and spent the weekend, and I could not believe the difference that it made in her life. You know, what it did for her, she actually was able to watch TV a little bit, read a book a little bit, you know, and actually have some, you know, conversation after that. And, it was an amazing change, of what I saw there. And, Of course, I'm a guy, so I don't need any help. So.
Oh, right. we all know that.
Right. You know, we don't read maps. We don't do anything. So, but she finally convinced me to go out there, not to do therapy with a horse. So her way of getting me there was just to go out and help do some work around the farm and do some stuff like that. And that got me hooked. Got me hooked with a horse, who I, you know, just kind of befriended, and he and I had just gotten along together, and I just saw the difference that it made in everybody else, including myself, which is the big thing. It truly helped me. You know, instead of every night, like I said, going to the edge of that cliff, it just kept me away from that. And I love it, and it's amazing to see what it does for the veterans who come there. And you can see what, you know, just the things that go on in their lives. So.
Yeah, you certainly can. And I have to admire both you and your wife for doing this, because I can't imagine what would happen if I'd lost my son anyway. And, you know, being reminded of it, as you mentioned, probably every day or every time you walk through a room somewhere. And how did the horse or horses communicate with you, or how do you communicate with the horse? Is it just this emotional tie that you have with them?
It becomes an emotional tie with them. It actually brings you to a place of peace, you know, in your life. When all the crazy things, you know, continue to go in your head and all those other things go on, all the reminders and everything, it's a place that you can go where you can be yourself. You're not judged. Mm-hmm. The horse doesn't judge you. The horse only looks at, you know, what are you going to do for me? Are you going to be my leader or are you not going to be my leader? You know, that horse really gets you. And there's an emotional bond and there's an emotional tie. And we started doing that. And then we started helping on the weekends with veterans. Mm-hmm. And you'd see other veterans come through on some of the overnight stays that we have and everything. Some guys, they don't want to be there, don't want to get off the bus from the VA.
Right.
You know, just want to have nothing to do with a horse, they want to have nothing to do with a farm. 2 hours later, by the time they're leaving, they don't want to leave. They don't want to go. How can I get back involved? How can I do stuff? Just because they're there on their own and it changes their life, you know, just that bonding with the horse.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see so many of the guys come back time and time again. Instead of having that blank stare when they first get off the bus, they go back home with a smile and they want to come back again. And my wife and I both said, you know, we love it so much to see what help we can give to other veterans. You know, because every veteran writes that blank check with their life when, you know, when they sign up to go off to war or just to join the military. And unfortunately, some don't come back. Our son didn't come back, but others do come back, and they're not whole. You know, there is PTSD, there's traumatic brain injuries, there's other injuries, and we can help those people. You know, they're not judged for anything. They can come back. They can be whole again, you know, within themselves and the horses that what actually helps them do it.
I think the idea of just somebody caring about them and making sure that these veterans know that there are so many organizations out there that care about them and want to make sure that they can make that transition from military to civilian or just back into life itself. All right, so are you going to be riding on the Trail to Zero?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am going to be riding there. We actually we bought a horse. We believe in the program so much. We bought a horse, and he's kind of back in the program. And his name is CJ's brother.
Okay. That's awesome. That is very awesome, Ken. I want to thank you very much for sharing this story with us here on Veterans Radio. And I encourage our listeners. We've got another gentleman I want to talk to, too. But I want to encourage our listeners to go to both of these websites. So first one is Brave Hearts Riding, and the next one is trailtozero.org, and it talks all about the upcoming event to, you know, just to raise awareness about the veteran suicide. You know, it's 20 a day, and it's not just current veterans. It's also Vietnam veterans. It's Operation Freedom. It's all the other things that are going on. So some of these men and women are having some real issues, and it's up to organizations like these to be out there so that they can help them. So Ken, thank you very much. I envy you being able to go on the ride, and I am glad that you were able to find the peace that you were looking for.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, we got one more here right now, and his name is Mitchell Reno. I'm sorry if I mispronounce your name, Mitchell. So welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, as I've already heard in talking with Megan and Ken, what a great organization this is. How did you get involved with it, and what does it do for you?
Well, you spoke earlier about the veteran going through North Chicago and coming out to the farm. I came out the same way. I went through that program. It's a stress STDU unit, PTSD, whatever, out there at North Chicago. And I came through it multiple times and went out to Bravehearts multiple times. And in between that time, I wrecked, totaled four cars. And in that process, I spent probably a couple months in the hospital. I had substance abuse problems. My adrenaline, I would speed, and that's how most of the time it happened. I went through rehabilitation and psych wards and you name it, and finally ended back up there after going through there two times. And I always came home, and I knew that was when I felt the best, was being there, and ended up back there. And long story short, I spent 28 days in the hospital up there and sobered up. And the day I walked out of there, I went and started spending time at Bravehearts really threw myself into it, because I don't know, deep down there was a sense of hope in all the recklessness and carelessness and not really caring for myself, or there was still a sense of hope, and multiple suicide attempts. I mean, my behavior on a daily basis was suicidal. And I went out there and started spending time. And what really caught me, was, Patty McKevitt, the old, director of operations, said to me, he saw me again. He was like, "Man, you really look like, you know, like, crap." And I was, that's putting his words lightly. And I was like, "Oh, thanks. Appreciate it." And, you know, it was the honesty, you know, he was honest with me. And, he, knew very much where I was coming from. And, out there, you get to be around veterans, and, that's always good. But, you know, he introduced me to this, Mustangs there. And, I just was instantly drawn to how fierce they were, and how, I mean, they were scared, you know, that they had just been collected, and that whole process. And I just felt the instant connection, you know, and it ended up working out, that, I got to, you know, be humbled by working, shoveling horse manure every morning. I mean, that lets you know exactly where you are in life. And I got to participate in riding lessons and seeing others change, as well as on the daily basis. I felt a little bit stronger. And I just, you know, the horses, I had done everything. I mean, every therapeutic psych thing that you could do, cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive processing therapy, eye movement, desensitization, rapid reprocessing. I actually, down here in Texas, I had Center for Brain Health tap on my hippocampus with a magnet from the space shuttle. And I'm not kidding. And it still didn't work. You know, I had like electroshock therapy and exposure therapy, all this stuff. And, you know, For all that happening, you know, I say I found the horses, but they found me through the process of working with both domestic and feral horses, and being there. You know, I learned not only to start trusting people, like, you know, that we say the lessons in the round pen are the lessons in the arena. They transcend that, those locations they go, and it starts working in your everyday life with human beings. And to be honest with you, I didn't trust a soul. I didn't trust anybody. And, I started to trust people, I started to notice that the horses trust me, and that was great to feel that I was actually a trustworthy human being. And just a lot of things, like, I could spend hours talking about
I know. Unfortunately, we don't have hours. I would love to have you all back on the program. After your ride, maybe we can get together and find out how that went.
That would be awesome.
I think so. Mitchell, I'm so glad that you were able to find this program, because you certainly kept you were trying and trying and trying, and you finally found the right one. So I want to encourage our audiences, again, to go to the BraveheartsRiding.org and also to go onto the TrailToZero.org to raise awareness of suicide, but not only suicide, but also how we can help these veterans, because it sounded like this is the place for Mitchell, it was a place for Ken, and obviously it's a place for Megan to run the whole thing. So I want to thank all three of you for being on Veterans Radio today, and we'll be in touch after your ride. So that's the 8th in Washington, D.C., and the 15th in New York City. So look out for them, folks. There's horses in their streets. Thank you all very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. We'll be back after the break with Jimmy Stewart, Mission and the Fight for Europe. We'll be right back after the news.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer. What a show.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and as the music indicates, we're going to be talking about coming in on a wing and a prayer. My guest the second half of the program is Robert Mattson, and Robert has written a great story about my favorite actor, and I think just a great human being, that's Jimmy Stewart. So I want to welcome Robert Mattson to Veterans Radio.
Hey, thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for writing this book. I got to tell our audience that he's written a lot of really other great stories, and so you need to go to his website. It's Robert Mattson, MATZEN.com, and it talks about some of his stories there. In fact, he's working on another one on one of my favorite actresses, Audrey Hepburn. So, and you've been a little bit busy with that one, right, Robert?
Yeah, that one's been, two solid years of work. I'm just wrapping it up now. And another just incredible experience being able to tell this story that hadn't been told.
Absolutely. And let's start right off with talking about Jimmy Stewart. He did not talk about his time in the service at all, did he?
No, the thing to understand about Stewart, a thing to understand, is that he was an introvert and a very closed off person. So he wasn't going to tell you anything personal in general. Mm-hmm. And he in particular would not tell you about his combat experiences during the war, which made the book seemingly, an impossible exercise. Like, how could I tell this story if he wouldn't tell it?
So how did you find out this information?
I started with his service record, his personnel file, and then I involved my researcher in D.C. The secret to being a good historical writer is to have good researchers.
Oh,
and,
yes.
so I asked her if she could find me information on Jimmy Stewart's combat experience in the 445th Bomb Group, 703rd Squadron, which was what he was assigned to when he went overseas. And within a couple of days, she came back with the complete combat record of the bomb group, down to, the date of the mission, who was on each plane, what the bomb load was, what the target was, what the wind speed was, where there were fighters encountered, where there was flak. You know, I had it all, and it was just a gold mine. And I realized then, I think I can write this book.
I can put this together. Well, let's go back and start back in, since you live in Pennsylvania, let's go back to Indiana, Pennsylvania, and talk about Jimmy Stewart's childhood and where he came from.
Well, the title of the book is Mission, and it, you think it's about a combat mission, but no, it's Jim's personal mission to serve his country. And just in the last couple of days, just watching the services for John McCain, hearing about John McCain, I am so reminded of Jimmy Stewart, because McCain's father was an admiral. His father was an admiral. And so McCain himself said, well, you know, I really didn't think I had any choice. I was going in the service. And that's exactly the experience that Stewart had, because both of his grandfathers had fought in the Civil War. One of them was one of the heroes of Gettysburg, just as much of a hero as Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain of the 20th Maine, was Colonel Sam Jackson of the 11th Pennsylvania Reserves. And that was Jim's mother's father. Jim's father's father, his other grandfather, was a sergeant in the U.S. Army Signal Corps who fought in the Shenandoah Valley in the latter half of the Civil War. And he was at Appomattox and watched Lee surrender to Grant. So, I mean, this is an incredible military tradition in the Stewart family. Jim's father was a captain of ordnance in the Great War, which became World War One, and served in the Low Countries. And when Jim was a kid, he watched his father go off to war. His father sent back, you know, bayonets and German helmets, and Jim would put plays on in his basement because he was so, you know, enraptured with the idea of serving. His mother made him a uniform to match his father's uniform. So, I mean, that's how he grew up, was just in the middle of this military tradition.
Okay. When was Jimmy Stewart born?
He was born in May of 1908.
Okay. Just to put it in perspective for all of our audience out there, right? All right. So, when did Jim get involved, or when did Mr. Stewart get involved in drama and theatrical life?
Well, he wasn't a very good student, and he and I share the thing where we were growing up and didn't know what we wanted to be. And so he changed majors in college, and he sort of drifted through. He went to Princeton because his father made him, but he didn't enjoy it. But then he found the acting company there, and he got into acting, which did not make his father happy at all. But it was the one thing that he loved, and it stuck. You know, after he graduated, he kept acting, and he made it to Broadway because, we have to set the stage that he was 6'4" and 149 pounds. So, I mean, this is a very tall, very thin, very unusual-looking guy, especially to be up on a stage.
Yes.
But there weren't many like him, so he was kind of unique in that way. And so, against all odds, really, because he was never considered handsome, especially when he was very young. He was kind of, you know, awkward-looking and awkward just acting. And so, because there was no other guy out there like him, he sort of stuck on Broadway.
Okay, we're talking with Robert Mattson. His book is Mission, Jimmy Stewart and the Fight for Europe. And it's a great read for those of you that like movie stories. That's the first third of the book. And then you got the war stories, and then you got more movie stories toward the end of it. But right in the middle are some great pictures that I've never seen of Jimmy Stewart. How did one of the things that you brought up here is that Stewart loved flying almost right from the beginning.
Yeah, that was another thing that came out of the Great War, was that there was a lot of literature, there were a lot of magazines that had aviation covers, and Jim got just very, very interested in flying. And after the war, there were veteran pilots who came home, and they had these Curtis Jenny aircraft that came out of the war surplus. And they would barnstorm around, and Jim got a flight at the age of 12. He saved up his allowance, and he got a flight in a barnstormer's plane, and he did this four or five more times, and it just sold him on flying. And he realized that, okay, I know I'm going to serve my country. I want to do it in an airplane. I want to be a pilot. And he set his sights on that early on, like as a teenager, and he fulfilled that mission, to the letter.
Yeah, absolutely. So he was interested. He was getting his license as a private pilot well before World War II.
Yeah, and he did that. You know, he was very calculated about it. It was the first thing he did with his money when he came to Hollywood was buy flying lessons and then buy his own airplane. And he bought an Army trainer. That's the plane that he chose because he wanted to when he got into the service, he wanted to have a leg up, and so he logged flight time for years, and he got his commercial rating just days before he went into the service.
So do you think he was thinking about joining the military any time during the 30s, or is this something that he knew was coming?
That's a good question. He was such a successful actor. He was sort of sucked into this stream of acting because he got a Hollywood contract, and he got out there, and he was so darn talented, just had this natural talent that they wanted to make him a character actor, and pretty soon he was starring in movies. Mm-hmm. And so he went along with that, but he had one eye on Europe the whole time. In fact, he took a trip to Europe at the end of the 1930s, and I think it was just to get the lay of the land. This was before Hitler's incursion into Poland. Jim went over to just, I really think he was scouting. He was doing an advanced scout for what he was going to see in the war.
Yeah, I think so. At least that's what it sounded like when I was reading the story. You watch him go along, and he's always got one. In today's world, he would always have his phone, you know, with a news feed going on at the same time.
Exactly.
So, all right, let's talk real briefly about his career in Hollywood. You know, because everybody kind of thinks that you know, Jimmy Stewart was this nice, calm young guy who never got in any trouble or anything like that, and he never really did get in any trouble, but he certainly had some good times out there, didn't he?
Yeah, he liked women an awful lot, and people are surprised. I've been criticized a bit because I went into such detail about his romantic exploits. You know, he the first woman he dated when he hit Hollywood was Ginger Rogers, who became Fred Astaire's partner. She had kind of a rough life, and she knew the streets a little bit, and so she gave Jim some early lessons. And then he moved from her to pretty much, you name it, Loretta Young, Marlena Dietrich, Olivia de Havilland, ended up with Dinah Shore, of all people, for a while. He was this quiet, intense, young guy, and the women really gravitated to him. And he became, there was, of course, Errol Flynn on one side of Hollywood, but on the other side, there was Jimmy Stewart, the aw shucks kid who just scored right and left with the ladies up until he went into the service.
I was going to say, he wasn't doing this. Didn't he hang out with Henry Fonda?
Fonda was his best friend, lifelong best friend. And, one of my friends wrote a book about it called Hank and Jim, about their friendship for 50 years.
I'm just looking here at the filmology. I don't know what it's called anyway. All the films he was in, before he really hit it big. It actually really hit it big right toward the end of the 1930s, and the romantic comedies and so on and so forth. And then he, as you mentioned earlier on, made that decision to join the Army Air Corps before the war even started.
Well, Uncle Sam made the decision for him. He was drafted.
Okay.
He was in the first draft class. He always said that he won the lottery. He said it was the only lottery he ever won because his number was so high it was sure he was going to get called. But the problem was he was 6'4" and 149 pounds, so he did not fit the model. And he was also much older than all the other pilots. So, I mean, he had two strikes against him going in. But he made his way in. You know, as I described, he got some help from Army doctors, and it got him into the service. And once he was in, then his flying ability and his maturity and his communication skills just sort of shot him right up the ladder against MGM, their wishes, against the War Department's wishes, because nobody, besides Jimmy Stewart, wanted him to go to Europe and fight because he wanted to be a pilot so he could get shot down. And, okay, so there's a movie star dead, but if he was to be captured, what was that going to do? You know, if Hitler had Jimmy Stewart as a in captivity, nothing good could come of that either.
Right. Well, he was, it was a, such a different world, you know, in the 1930s and 1940s, and we just can't relate to the idea that these actors were giving up their careers to go into the military to fight for America, and that, you know, he didn't want to be, you know, just making PR films for, you know, join the military or sell bonds and so forth. He actually wanted to get in on the action, and he was lucky enough, I don't know if it's lucky or not, but he was able to convince them that, you know, to let him go and fly. But they didn't let him fly that much, did they?
Well, he became a trainer of other pilots, you know, because he was so much older. He was so good at the controls that he worked his way up to teaching the operation of B-17 four-engine bombers.
Okay.
And but that was stateside. He was all over the western United States at different bases teaching pilots for more than a year, and it was eating him up inside. But finally, I believe I have come to believe since the book was written, I couldn't figure out how he actually ended up being allowed to go overseas. And what I think happened was that the 8th Air Force was having such a bad time of it. Their first wave of planes and crews had pretty much been obliterated, and times were so desperately tough that A, they needed his skills, and B, they needed a success story. So if he didn't get shot down, he could become a hero, and I think that's why they finally let him go.
Okay. So he ends up in England and flying missions over Germany, correct? Bombing missions?
Yes.
And the detail that you go into in the book is I can't imagine. I'm always amazed at people that were on B-17s and or 24s and 25s and so forth, how they had the courage to go in knowing they were going to get shot at a lot. And and a lot of them weren't coming back. I mean, there was a built-in rate, I think, of how many people they were going to lose on these missions, because you're sending over hundreds and hundreds of B-17s, and you know that not all of them are going to come back. But he did. And he went through some harrowing experiences.
I was lucky enough to speak with a number of guys from his bomb group. And these were, in fact, the three that helped me the most all were shot down over Holland or Germany. And all in pretty short order. They were shot down within like 3 months, right after Jim got over there. And he knew them all. And they gave me such insight into not only what Stuart was like in the service, but what the experience of flying those bombers was like on those, you know, 6, 7, 8 hour missions where at altitude in European winter, it's 30 below zero, you know, your oxygen mask freezes. If you expose your skin, if your flight suit stops working, and they had electric flight suits, but they were primitive. If it stops working, then, you know, you get frostbite in 30 seconds, that kind of thing. It's something that we really can't imagine today. It's nothing like if you watch the TV show 12 O'Clock High back in the day, you know, you think it's just sort of fun up there. Well, it wasn't fun up there.
No.
No.
We've had the privilege of talking to pilots and door gunners and so forth on B-17s and 24s, and as much as they will tell, you know, great stories about it, it was harrowing to be up there. I mean, people are shooting at you, you know, throwing up bowling balls at you.
Yeah, and I had to experience B-17 and B-24 flights, and I did do that just to get a grounding in. You know, what's a takeoff like? What's altitude like? What's it like to crawl around in there? And one thing that you just can't imagine is how loud it is. You know, those four Pratt & Whitney engines right next to you, and how loud that is. And it cost Jim part of his hearing. He had to learn to lip read after the war because he couldn't hear the cues. He couldn't hear his co-stars. And that was something that he just didn't talk about. And finally it got so bad that drove him out of acting.
Really? I wasn't even aware of that. Well, I can understand losing your hearing with aircraft. But, I guess I don't want to run out of time. I want to make sure we get in this. So can you talk about maybe one of his adventures while he was a pilot over there?
Yeah, he, somewhere around his 9th or 10th mission was during what was called Big Week, where the 8th Air Force made a concerted effort to knock out the German aviation manufacturing industry. You know, they wanted to take out the next wave of German fighters and bombers that were going to be... They had to do that before D-Day could be possible. Mm-hmm. And so Jim's mission was to Gotha, Germany, and the day before, his bomb group had been decimated. I mean, they had lost something like 17 bombers in one day. And the next day, Jim had to leave the same bomb group back for another go at Gotha, Germany. And that was the day that a flak shell burst under the cockpit and blew a 2-foot hole between his legs.
Ooh.
At altitude, at 20,000 feet. He can see down into Germany. His map case went down out this hole. And so here he is in a crippled plane, that, and it also lost an engine on the bomb run. So they're down to three engines, and they have this hole, and he has to somehow get back to base. So the story there is just sort of crazy, you know, that they did get back. But it was the one that broke him. You know, he was broken after that. He was never quite the same. He went what they call flak happy for the first of two times where, you know, it was PTSD. There's no other way to describe it. And he brought it home with him, and he lived it for years. His daughter told me that he would have nightmares, and the nightmares always involved German fighters swarming around his airplane. And he, in his sleep, he would be calling out, you know, he would be calling out orders and how to deal with these fighters.
I can't imagine. You know, what these men and women went through, at anybody who's in that situation of flying when people are shooting at you and your aircraft is kind of disintegrating around you and you still get back and you're losing friends and you know, you don't get, it's emotional even just thinking about it. And as a result of this, as you mentioned, you know, that Jimmy Stewart did probably suffer from post-traumatic stress for the rest of his life. In fact, when he did get out of the service, the first movie that he made was probably all of our favorites, It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, that always struck me. It was the first thing that really struck me, and it was the first thing I wrote in this book was, here's this guy who's come back from what he's experienced, which is 20 combat missions, and he's seen so many of his friends and the people that he was commanding not come back, and here he is in the land of make-believe again. Mm-hmm. And they built Bedford Falls, you know, which, if you remember the end of the movie, there's this big snowy scene. Well, they built Bedford Falls in the desert of Encino, California, and they had, the snow was fake. When he shot that scene, it was over 90 degrees, and I just couldn't even imagine what was going through his mind. You know, here he is. He was in real life in these crazy situations, and now he's in the land of make-believe in California. And that's the way the book starts and ends, you know, is trying to make sense of it for him, because it couldn't really have made any sense after what he had experienced.
No, I mean, as you mentioned, the real life issues that he was going through, and then you have George Bailey, who's, you know, just more or less shot down every time he's almost ready to break out of Bedford Falls, and something happens, and something happens, and something happens, and I'm sure that Jimmy Stewart felt the same way when he would go out on a mission, because you lose so many friends on those missions. And wow. We're talking with Robert Mattson here on Veterans Radio. The book is Mission. It's Jimmy Stewart and the Fight for Europe. So what about his career afterwards? You said he had difficulty hearing, but his career still was very successful after World War II.
He's a very smart man. And what he did was, you see it first in It's a Wonderful Life, he's got an edge. He never had this edge before he went to war, but he came home with a dark side, and he came home with an edge. And he learned with his first picture that he could use it and control it to some degree and let it come out in the dark side of these characters. And he did it again and again. Winchester 73 is a great Western. Mm-hmm. And he loses his temper in the middle of it, and he smashes his co-star's head again into the bar, and he strangles him, and, you know, and he does things like this. Rear Window, he's a voyeur, and picture after picture, they're of his favorite, most interesting pictures, the Anthony Mann westerns, Naked Spur.
Right.
You know, he's seeking revenge, and there was a lot of that. The Man from Laramie, seeking revenge, and that was all what he determined that he could bring an added dimension to his craft was really what he brought back from Europe. And he mastered it where other people, you know, would not be smart enough or cunning enough or whatever to be able to harness some of that. He did.
I was just thinking as I was going through this list how his characters changed from the, you know, the light comedies, I guess you could say, of the late 30s, and then some of the darker films that he made, and then, of course, the westerns, as you said, where he really could let his, you know, inner anger come out legitimately. So let's, we've only got about a minute left, Robert. I'll give you a chance to sum it up, I guess, as they say.
Yeah, well, I went into the project sort of neutral on Stewart. I was never the biggest fan of his, but I have nothing but tremendous respect for this man and what he accomplished, what he overcame. And I feel like he's a friend now, you know. I almost met him a couple times in my career, and I feel now like I know this guy, and I like him a lot.
He's a very likable character, and I want to thank you very much, Robert, for being on our program. And I encourage people to go out and buy this book. I know it came out. It's on Amazon. It's everywhere. So get it. Thanks for being on the program.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. All right. Well, we've got another one in the can, as they say. I encourage you to go out and read this story. It's a fascinating story. We got 10 seconds to go, so I'm going to say it all. So until next week, you are dismissed.